Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
If you go back in time, and we are talking about circa 1947, after the Second World War, and when the war, Europe is rebuilding itself and whatnot, the U.S. and Europe and some countries in Asia, but was pretty much the U.S. and some of the countries that nowadays are the European Union, had this general agreement on trade and tariff. That's sort of the grandfather of the WTO, the World Trade Organization. So back then, you had excessively high levels of protection.
Nelson Villarreal, Kansas State Ag Economics Professor.
When they start, and we're talking about the average across products, so it's an average, it was, talking about high levels of protection, was around 22%.
This is Agriculture Today.
Once you get to numbers like 125, that was one thing they commented that we agree with. It doesn't really matter, because it's a decoupling of trade.
Director General of the World Trade Organization Ngozi Okonjo-Iweala saying, doesn't matter what tariff rates are, it just stops trade.
So this is what precisely I talked about, that we are seeing a move towards decoupling U.S.-China trade. Beyond the 125, 145, it doesn't really matter how much you raise it. The trade is decoupled. And we've already made statements about the risks and the possible impact of decoupling. It's not just about China and U.S., it's the impact on the rest of the world. If we get this decoupling resulting in a fragmentation of world trade, resulting in two blocks, that's my biggest worry. Because nations do not want to choose to be on one or the other. They want to be able to trade within the global trading system. So we have to absolutely find a way to avoid this fragmentation into two possible blocks.
But who pays the tariff? Nelson Villarreal is a Kansas State Ag Economics professor.
Technically, the importer pays a tariff to the customs authority. This is why tariffs are a source of government revenue. And if we look at the numbers today, tariffs are around 2% of total government revenue. So if you think about all the money that the government gets, 50% of that it's income taxes. Another 35, almost 40%, it's Social Security and Medicare taxes. What comes out of our paycheck, you have corporate taxes. Tariff, that's at 2%, give or take, of that revenue. So that's what goes to the government. This doesn't mean, of course, that the importer is absorbing the tariff and reducing the profits. What happens is that the importer passes that increase onto consumers or to the overseas producers. That's what we call the incidence of the tariff. And the question here, which of these groups will bear the brunt of the tariff? The foreign producers that we are taxing or the domestic consumers that are within the country where the tariff is applied? And the answer depends fundamentally on the market share that we have of a product. If we don't buy a lot of, if we buy a pretty small share of a good and we put a tariff on that, it's very unlikely that foreign producers decide to lower their prices or reduce their profits. They probably are going to basically push the prices onto consumers. Okay, that's what we call the tariff pass-through. Now, if we are a pretty dominant country, we import 90% of a given product, it's very likely that when we tax that product, foreign producers decide to lower their prices. And in that sense, we are pushing the cost of the tariff towards those foreign producers. Still, you generally will have increases in domestic prices and consumers will still have a higher cost. But now you are sharing the cost with foreign producers. So say if a tariff of 10% and you have quite a bit of market power, prices may go up here within the U.S. by 3% and foreign producers reduce their profits by 7%, and you get the revenues from the government, and so forth. So that's basically how tariffs are paid for.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
So April gives us a quarterly update on the steers and heifers on feed. And this is a number that I was, you know, really looking forward to seeing. I think a lot of eyes were on this, you know, almost as much as just the general monthly cattle on feed report.
Oklahoma State livestock economist Dr. Darrell Peel.
For April 1, the number of heifer calves on feed was about 37.6% of the total on-feed inventory. That is a decline, and in fact, that's the lowest heifer on-feed percentage in 5 years. It's been since 2020 that we saw this percentage this low. So this may be our first really kind of data-driven indication that the industry is beginning to hold some heifers, retaining those heifers, and that would lead to eventual herd rebuilding. Now, I would say, you know, one quarter's number, we probably want to see it verified with another smaller number next quarter. The next one will be in July. But I think it's a very solid indication for the first time in 5 years that we've seen that number come down to about the long-term average level.
Is it too soon to say rebuilding?
You know, this question of herd rebuilding is one we've been watching for 15 or 18 months now. And as I said, the quarterly cattle on feed numbers may be our first indication that we're beginning to retain some heifers with that heifer on feed percentage starting to drop. Now, it hasn't dropped to a level that for sure indicates that we're retaining, but it maybe is the first step to that. I think the key going forward is going to be, you know, it's really several things that have played into why it's taken so long to get this process started. But one of the overriding ones has been the fact that not only was it drought that got us here over the last 4 years or so, that's what caused the liquidation and resulted in us having the very tight numbers that we have right now. But continuing and sort of lingering drought and drought threats is one of the factors that is making producers, keeping producers very cautious about expanding or getting too aggressive in that process. So, and this is a critical time of year. If you look at the drought map right now for the U.S., we don't have any major areas of extreme or what they call exceptional drought in the worst drought categories, if you will, in the drought monitor map. But we have a lot of areas that are sort of marginally in drought. The first, D1, D2 categories. And the thing about that, at this time of the year, with temperatures starting to go up, warmer weather, lots of wind typically in the spring, those drought conditions can redevelop very quickly. So I think the next 6 or 8 weeks is going to be a very critical period across, particularly in the southern half of the country, and then spring will be right on its heels in the northern half of the country. And so these next few weeks will be really critical to sort of set the stage for what producers can do or may have to do relative to the drought conditions. And then we're back to the question of, okay, if drought and forage conditions are not a limiting factor, then are producers ready and starting to make that management decision to restock and to retain some heifers for some herd expansion, some herd rebuilding? And that's a bit of an open question, but maybe we're beginning to get some indications that producers are ready to do it. If we can, we'll see what how the drought conditions. The overall forecast from the meteorologist is not that promising. The broader, longer term outlook for the first half of the year still shows pretty drought conditions. However, we've seen some moisture in some parts of the southern plains recently that, at least is going to give us a start on that process. So I think we just have to watch the next few weeks and see how these conditions develop.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
The time to fix our forest is now.
The chairman of the Natural Resources Committee is the only forester in Congress. From Arkansas, Bruce Westerman.
Actually, now is not the real time to fix our forest. The time to have fixed our forest was yesterday. It was last year. It was 10 years ago. It was 30 years ago. The condition our forests are in now is a result of bad management decisions over a long period of time. It's kind of like the saying about planting a tree. The best time to have done it was when you're a child. The next best time is today. If not today, we need to do it tomorrow. Regardless of where and when catastrophic wildfires occur, they offer a grim lesson. The cost of thoughtful prevention would have been far less than those inflicted by merciless flames. the old adage of an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure is never more true than when it comes to managing our forest. We spend billions of dollars fighting fire every year. Our forest should be an income stream to our federal government, not a cost. People manage forests all over the country, and they actually produce great products that go into homes, that go into sustainable buildings, that actually become a carbon sink because wood is 50% by weight carbon. And when you build with wood, this table was atmospheric carbon that was stored in this wood at some point in history, and it's still in this wood. Instead of burning these forests up and spewing more carbon into the atmosphere, we should be looking at innovative ways to use our forests, to keep them healthy and resilient, because they do provide clean air, they provide clean water, they provide wildlife habitat. But they don't do that when they're burned to the ground. And these fires oftentimes are so hot that they burn the organic material out of the soil. So it's hard to get trees to grow back. We've seen this in the Angora fire. I visited it several years ago. It was 12 years after the fire, and it had been replanted 6 times, and the trees still wouldn't grow on it because the soil had been so damaged by these intense wildfires. The argument has been made that these fires are a result of climate change. If that is the case, the question still remains, what are we going to do about it? We have unhealthy forests. They're way overstocked, way more trees per acre than we've ever seen. Small trees that are competing with other trees for light, for water and nutrients, and they get weakened and they die and insects and disease come in. And this just isn't California. It's all across our country. We know what to do. The question is, will we do it? The Fix Our Forest Act will give us the opportunity to do what we know needs to be done. I've talked to many of our land managers, federal land managers across the country. It's disheartening to them to have gone to forestry school or whatever educational experience they had, and they wanted to commit their life to working in an area to make a difference. And they see these resources they're charged with taking care of going up in flames. And instead of being land managers and forest managers, they're firefighters. That's really what most of the budget for our federal agencies goes to anymore, is to fight fires. It doesn't have to be that way. This is something that should be bipartisan. It is going to be bipartisan today. It's something the Senate should take up in a bipartisan manner and get it to President Trump's desk as soon as possible.
It passed the House by a vote of 279 to 141, is now sitting in committee in the Senate. It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
Now, I want to be clear, America's partners need not look exactly like America, nor must our governments do everything exactly the same way. But we should have some common goals, and I believe here in India we do, in both economics and in national security. And that's why we're so excited. That's why I'm so excited to be here today. In India, America has a friend, and we seek to strengthen the warm bonds our great nations already share.
Vice President J.D. Vance on a 4-day visit to India addressing members of the business community.
India, like America, wants to build. And that will mean that we have to produce more energy. That's more energy production and more energy consumption. And it's one of the many reasons why I think our nations have so much to gain by strengthening our energy ties. As President Trump is fond of saying, America has once again begun to drill, baby, drill. And we think that will inure to the benefit of Americans, but will also benefit India as well. Past administrations in the United States of America, I think motivated by a fear of the future, have tied our hands and restricted American investments in oil and natural gas production. This administration recognizes that cheap, dependable energy is an essential part of making things and is an essential part of economic independence for both of our nations. Of course, America is blessed with vast natural resources and an unusual capacity to generate energy, so much that we want to be able to sell it to our friends like India. We believe your nation will benefit from American energy exports and expanding those exports. You'll be able to build more, make more, and grow more, but at much lower energy costs. We also want to help India explore its own considerable natural resources, including its offshore natural gas reserves and critical mineral supplies. We have the capacity and we have the desire to help.
Vance and Prime Minister Modi have been discussing trade and relations.
We think energy co-production will help beat unfair competitors in other foreign markets. But India, we believe, can go a long way to enhance energy ties between our nations. And one suggestion I have is maybe consider dropping some of the non-tariff barriers for American access to the Indian market. Now, I've talked about this, of course, with Prime Minister Modi. And look, President Trump and I know that Prime Minister Modi is a tough negotiator. He drives a hard bargain. It's one of the reasons why we respect him. And we don't blame Prime Minister Modi for fighting for India's industry. But we do blame American leaders of the past for failing to do the same for our workers. And we believe that we can fix that to the mutual benefit of both the United States and India. Let me give an example. American ethanol, we believe made from the finest corn in the world, can play a tremendous role in enhancing our partnership. And I know our farmers would be delighted to support India's energy security ambitions. We welcome the Modi government's budget announcement to amend India's civil nuclear liability laws, which currently prevent U.S. producers from exporting small modular reactors and building larger U.S.-designed reactors in India. There's much that we can create, much that we can do together. We believe that American energy can help realize India's nuclear power production goals, and this is very important, as well as its AI ambitions. Because as the United States knows well, and I know that India knows well, there is no AI future without energy security and energy dominance.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
My level of concern is heightened.
Ngozi Okonjo-Iweala is the Director General of the World Trade Organization.
I'm very concerned. For all the reasons we said before, the slowdown in fact, turnaround, contraction in global merchandise trade growth is of big concern. And as we said, if the downside risks materialize, one of which might very well do so, the 90-day pause, if the reciprocal tariffs come back, layered with uncertainty over it, you can see a 1.5 percentage point contraction with both those things. So a heightened, this means, as you know, there's a strong relationship between trade growth and overall GDP, global GDP growth. In the past, actually, growth of trade drove global GDP growth. More recently, they've been growing in tandem, like 1-to-1, before it was 2-to-1. So there's a relationship. And so if we have contraction in global merchandise trade growth, the concern is spillover into, you know, overall GDP growth, as Ralph mentioned. And, you know, we've seen that the trade concerns can have negative spillovers into financial markets, into other broader areas of the economy. But I'm also very concerned about impact on poor countries, developing countries. And we really need to think about that. And the 44 least developed countries, how do we safeguard them and make sure that they are not as hard hit? They're very vulnerable. So those are my concerns. Don't waste a crisis. Yes, absolutely. I think WTO members recognize. You could see it last week when we had an event to reflect on our 30th anniversary, that a whole group of members got together to say that the critical thing we need to focus on is reform. I call it now, because reform is used so often, I want it to be a repositioning of the organization. And I think it's well accepted. I think the critical issue for us is the modalities to agree on a process for doing it and very sharp on those things that need to be reformed. We have to look at issues of level playing field, because there's a lot of concern. Different types of subsidies. Members, the U.S., as you know, is very concerned about unlevel playing field, and the EU. China is concerned about agricultural subsidies. The developing countries are concerned that policy space for their industrialization and growth is not there. These are all issues we have to examine within the reform. Even other processes of the way we work have to be looked at. So I think there's an agreement that we shouldn't waste this crisis. We should reposition it. We wouldn't be here if everything were working very well. And then you talked about the 74% MFN. Yes, the comforting thing is how strongly members feel that they need to maintain this MFN. So the conversations I've been having in these past 2 weeks, round the clock, with many ministers and ambassadors, what has really comforted me in a way is they are sometimes the first to raise this and say, how do we protect the MFN? So we're expecting, as you know, all the discussion on the issues and the tariffs is not only about tariffs. That is very clear. There are other issues on the table that are beyond the WTO's terms of reference in the sense of certain types of taxes, different types of transactions that cannot be handled at the WTO.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
You see a whole bunch of dry, but nobody really worrying terribly about it yet.
Dr. Dan O'Brien is a Kansas State University grain economist and says, when looking at weather conditions...
So you see that the calculated soil moisture anomaly in the United States as of, say, April the 16th, and you see really dryness all the way from the Illinois-Indiana border and some into Illinois, all the way over to throughout Nebraska, down into most of Kansas now, up into the South Dakota, parts of North Dakota, Iowa, for the most part having that situation. You also see other sources of information that we look towards are also indicating quite a bit of dryness. So we'll be able to plant. No problem. Get the crop in. And then when it's, for the most part, if it's in dry conditions like this, but it will, on the other side of that, raise the question about having adequate moisture to really get the crop underway and go forth. The last 7 day accumulated precipitation versus normal is, I'm looking at a map, and blue color on the U.S. map is lots of extra moisture. A dark brown color on the U.S. state by state map is pretty dry, and we are as dry as a bone in, well, basically anything going to the west of Illinois and all the way down to the U.S.-Mexico border. For the most part, up to South Dakota, there's some wetness up in Canada, North Dakota border off in there, but so we'll see. You know, that can shift around in a big hurry, but pretty dry there. If you look at the last 30 days for dryness, really that the state that looks the worst at this time is unfortunately ours here in Kansas. Kansas looks pretty dry. And I guess that's why we're so focused on water conservation and no-till, or at least moisture-conserving practices to help us grow crops in years like this. Nebraska has some dryness, et cetera, but I guess the game is on, in a way. Hopefully, I don't know if it's so much of a humorous comment, but, man, you know, now we're watching the weather here in the U.S. We'll see what happens when the crops get in, and we'll be watching to see what the development of the crops will be.
That's on the growing or production side of the equation, but then you have to have buyers. That means exports.
One thing I would say, and our good friend and colleague Guy Allen's talked about it, is at how the lower U.S. dollar has helped us to help spur exports of some of our grains on. And the one that stands out the most, it's kind of surprising to see the numbers that came out on Thursday for the corn exports for the weekend, April the 10th. Again, 74 million bushels, which is very, very good. We need a pace of about 52 to meet the USDA's projections. So that's really good. Sorghum still struggling, really affected by U.S.-China trade tensions. Wheat numbers for exports, just so-so. For hard red winter, we need about 7.1 million bushels per week to meet the USDA's projection. And we had about 5.25 last week for the week ending April the 10th, so a challenge there. And for soybeans, we had about 26, 27 million bushels of soybean exports, but need about a pace of about 13.6 to meet the USA's projection. However, that's kind of a number that'll fool you, in that the U.S. has a very narrow window that they're leader in the world export market for soybeans, because that South American crop comes in and just tends to wash over everybody. So you got that happening now, or starting to happen.
Kansas State grain economist Dan O'Brien. It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
You know, the April cattle on feed report showed us that placements in the month of March came in at 105% of last year. That was a little bit above the average trade guess, but it wasn't outside the range of guesses. So maybe you take that as a slightly bearish number, but not a major shock.
It's Oklahoma State livestock economist Dr. Darrell Peel.
Marketings in March were 101% of last year, and that's really close to what the trade expected coming into this. And so that gives us an April 1 on-feed total that's 98.4% of last year, so rounds to 2% down, which is what we were down last month as well. Didn't drop farther on a year-over-year basis, but continuing to tighten up, and I think we will see that number drop more as we go forward.